We are back. I want to say I'm sorry, you guys, for the delay between shows here, but we should be back on a regular schedule now. I had a baby on the way, as you guys know, and that's kind of a, it's been a little bit of a rough go every time, but he's doing well now. He's out of the NICU. He's supposed to be off of oxygen today. Everything's going well there. Books, the Glass Factory, they have shipped, finally, so we're done fighting the supply chain issues on the publisher side. Apologize for that too. There's nothing, absolutely nothing I could do about that. That was all the publisher, but those things have shipped. So you should be getting those right about the time, sometime here pretty quick. I guess I won't speak for the post office because you know how slow they are. In this episode, we're going to check in with Joe Kent and see how his race is going. As you guys know, he's the only candidate in this race that matters, and I just love the guy. He really is the best of us. Thanks again, Joe. This is Braxton McCoy. I'm back here with Joe Kent. After we did, Joe actually did the very first episode of this podcast, which was cool. And after that, we had talked and said it would be neat to do an update, as you know, sort of as the campaign progressed. So I know that there's been some interesting developments. If you're okay with it, I wouldn't mind starting by talking about that poll that you posted a week or two ago.
Yeah, man, I would, because the poll turned out really well, I'd love to brag about it. So we had, for whatever reason, the Trafalgar Group, which is a pretty well-known polling organization for people who aren't like knee deep in the Politico world. Trafalgar is the organization that called Trump winning Michigan and Wisconsin and a couple in Ohio, I believe, in 2016. So they're one of the few polling groups that didn't have egg on their face in November of 16. So they took interest in this race and then kind of out of the blue published some pretty nice results for us. So overall, I'm only 7 points behind my 11-year incumbent, Jamie Herrera Butler, 10 points up from all of my competitors, my nearest competitor. And then I am 10 points ahead in positive name recognition for people who knew both of us. So I'm kind of suffering from a lack of name recognition, but for people that knew both Jamie Herrera Butler and me, I was up 10 points from her, which is pretty bad for someone who's been around for 11 years. And I've been at this since February. So pretty happy to see that, that response.
Yeah, totally. In fact, that was what stuck out to me the most was your positive name recognition was quite high and hers was actually quite low, but then your overall name recognition was kind of quite a bit lower than hers, but then your negative name recognition was like nothing. It was very, very low. It was like 11%, 10% or something. It was very, very low. So I thought it was neat. I was like, holy cow, this guy might actually pull this thing off.
I never, as you know, and everybody else knows, I haven't ever run for anything before. So I just kind of been going with my instincts. Obviously, once we made some money, I brought in a guy like Matt Brainerd, who's very intelligent on this political game that we're playing. But I've been really running a kind of campaign from my heart. I haven't really gotten much coaching on what to say or you know, where to go. We've just been attempting to be kind of everywhere in the district and then everywhere on the media. So podcasts and anybody who will basically let me deliver my message, we've been reaching out to and just exploiting every opportunity. So that's been good to see. I think it just speaks to how sick and tired people are of the status quo.
Yeah, I think you're right. And we're kind of feeling that everywhere. It seems even in more of the kind of libertarian media sphere, there's some big changes happening there. And it's not just like the new, you know, the Mises caucus, they're doing their own thing, or they've sort of got their new strategy, which is interesting. I follow that stuff a little bit too, but some of the older voices, even in libertarianism, are talking in very new and fresh ways. And so I think you're seeing this, like, it's almost as if there are coalitions scattered throughout this sort of political world that are all looking for an answer to the problem at the same time. Does that make sense? It's like you're kind of seeing the same similar behaviors in different areas of politics right now, that like everyone's sort of scrambling for an answer to the status quo is what it seems like.
Yeah, I agree, man. I mean, I think there's a big, when I hit on, the key themes of my campaign, which overall is that the elites and the establishment have really failed us and do not have our best interests in mind. That resonates with people for different reasons. Sometimes the economic message really gets people, fired up about shipping our manufacturing overseas or what's been done to our timber and natural resources industry here. Other times it's the endless wars, the foreign policy, that type of thing. But then we also have had, we were on the front lines of the breakdown of law and order in two major cities. And so again, that establishment failure there too just speaks heavily. So I do think you're right. There's people that are looking for different solutions, but then also someone that's not going to, sugarcoat it and give them the same old, hey, we're going to solve this with like tax cuts and conservative principles that I won't really define, but I'm just going to say conservative principles a whole bunch. So that's it's just the nature of the way things are right now. And especially, I don't know how you guys are probably way more sane out there in Idaho, but our governor is kind of on the warpath again with the COVID restrictions. He never really let up with them. So that's created a whole another wave of people who just never were politically active before that are showing up at events and are just really hungry to hear a message that says we don't have to just lay here and take it.
Well, I love to hear. So the lockdowns are one of the things that got me so loud about politics. I've always been, I used to be kind of apolitical, but I always kind of followed it and paid attention. I just wasn't a diehard at all. But the lockdowns really got me wound up. So if you're, let's say you're going back into that, and it sounds like we all may be in the future. What do you do from your position to help your constituency, because it's really the governor that's doing it to him, right?
Yeah, it's our governor. I mean, but it's our governor, but we've also had some of our, I guess I would call them part of the administrative state, really in the education realm that are going along with this. So Inslee is an absolute activist. He doesn't get anywhere near as much as no, enough credit. I was telling people at CPAC that Inslee is the Cuomo of the West. Because he was actually stuffing old people into nursing homes way before Cuomo was.
Oh, really?
And these are people that were coming from the Pacific, so they were even geographically closer to China. So he deserves way more credit in this than he gets. But he wants to put, he's already actually gone through this. He's doing this right now. He's putting vaccine clinics in high schools. Washington State has this really horrible, they call it a mature minor status. And this has been really turned against parents in this state where if your kid
Whoa.
is 13 years old, the school doesn't have to disclose medical issues back to the parents. And there's horror story after horror story with this. This has been used for kids to, essentially submit claims that they're being abused when they're not, but then also to start gender therapy, all kinds of horrible,
Whoa.
things that, not mature minors that are being allowed to go off on these. I don't know even know how to describe it. They're being enabled to do harmful things to their bodies without the consent of their parents. There's that clause there too. They're sticking the vaccine clinics in the schools and then socially pressuring kids to get the vaccines. And then there's also Inslee's trying to make sure that he wants everyone vaccinated by the fall. Otherwise, the kids that are not vaxxed, they have to get tested once every 2 weeks and continue to wear masks. So they'll be segregated too in the schools. So really what I've done, I mean, my kids go to school here too, so I'm concerned about it as a parent, is just show up to as many events as I can and go to school board meetings. And that's really helped me keep my finger on the pulse of what's going on. And it's really actually been pretty, both shocking but also inspiring. It's shocking to listen to some of these bureaucrats talk and justify. I sat in a meeting with a superintendent who I'm sure is generally an intelligent person, but he was trying to tell these parents that, look, we just had to all hurry. We all had to hurry up and get our kids vaccinated so that the government would let us take our masks off. And I was just like, do you hear the words that are coming out of your mouth, man? Like what you're
Wow.
saying right now. Like we have to just do something that we all think is wrong that could have damage that we can't even fully define yet, just so we can all take our masks off. Like, what's making you have your mask on right now? And he, for whatever reason, he's just in this mindset that you have to do exactly what the government says, otherwise you're a bad human. So it's awe-inspiring out here, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to delve too far into this, but what we learned in 2020 is that it was not an exaggeration to say that the left has kind of turned politics into a religion. People have been saying that for years.
Oh yeah.
But I mean, it is fully evident on its face now that it is literally a religion to them.
I thought I understood that before 2020, but I don't think I fully grasped it, especially going to these meetings and listening, like that superintendent I just talked about. But I've heard other administrators say, well, this is just the way it is. And I'm like, you're speaking like you have no actual free will or agency. Like you haven't. And I mean, I get it. Like in March of 2020 or February, I guess March, you know, that spring of 2020, I understood nobody had enough data really to make informed decisions. And there was some blind faith that we had to put into our institutions. I think a lot of us that have, you know, been in the military and been in government, we were pretty skeptical, but you know, that's based on our personal experiences. But if you didn't have those personal experiences, like I get it. But now that we're a year and a half past that, man, it just boggles my mind. But the government's done a good job of setting up like an incentive system, you know, along with the media that labels anybody who's not adhering to exactly what Fauci and the CDC says, that then you must be a other person. You must be a Trump supporter. You must be a science denier or whatever. And you know, in our circles, I think we all laugh at that, but there's a lot of folks out there that they're stuck in there. And you can, but at these meetings, I think you can see some of these people who have never even been politically active, or they've never considered themselves to be like a conservative or a Trump supporter or whatever. You can kind of see them get red pilled. And it's been that's been neat to watch, because it's, you know, folks that probably wouldn't have cared until their kids got messed with.
Yeah, that, you know, that kind of happened to my wife. She's very much a normie, and you know, all this talk about vaccinating kids has pushed her over the edge, you know, like vaccinating kids for COVID specifically has really pushed her over the edge. So I believe it. I'll bet there's a lot of suburban house moms, or however you want. Of course, we don't live in suburbs, but you know what I mean, that are waking up, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, man, definitely.
Well, so you're talking about being othered. They have been othering anyone who was a Trump guy. Like, you've been a Trump guy forever, but they've been like othering people like you for at least 5 years now. But now they're taking it to a brand new level. We always, in fact, the last time we talked about how they were, you know, you couldn't straight up say they were colluding, but it was pretty obvious that they were colluding with the government. Right. I mean, it was like pretty clear. And now you've got Psaki, you know, Psaki or whatever the heck her name is, out there just straight up saying that, there's Facebook members of in Joe Biden's cabinet. There are people that used to work for Facebook and used to work for YouTube. So we know that's there. But it's a whole nother thing to have, you know, the press secretary saying straight up, yes, we're colluding with the largest social media network in the world to kick you off. But what we think the problem is that that's not going far enough. Everyone else should take Facebook's, you know, if you get booted from Facebook, then you should lose your privileges to banking, is basically what it sounded like she was saying, you know.
Well, I mean, she was laying it all out there in the open and essentially saying that, you know, our social media platforms just became like the new Ministry of Information. You know, it's just like that they're going to be the arbiters, you know, in direct coordination with the government, which is absolutely insane. Third world banana dictator republic type of stuff, whatever label you want to put on it. It's the opposite of what America is supposed to be. And, you know, it's all the veils I think have been dropping in the last year. And this is one of the last ones. And then, you know, later on that day, or maybe a day later, when Joe Biden answered that question kind of off the cuff, that someone asked him about Psaki's comments, and Biden justified it by saying, well, the people that are spreading disinformation, they're killing people, which I think is pretty incredible, because, you know, the whole labeling of others things, when you label someone as an other, like Trump is literally Hitler, that gives you a free pass to do kind of anything, because you do anything to stop a guy like Hitler. It's very dangerous, I think, when someone like Biden says, like, well, they're killing people. And if they're killing people, the assumption is he is the president who has a good deal of control over the elements that have the monopoly on violence by the state. Mm-hmm. He could deploy those and turn those loose. That's not a that's not a conspiracy theory or a really far bridge mentally to jump from. Because if he's saying that, he's articulating that, he's almost giving himself this duty that he has to somehow stop that. So it's pretty incredible to watch in real time.
Well, and you just take Biden's career in the Congress and Senate, and he has always been pro-war. He doesn't have a problem killing people. That's never been an issue for him, except for Bin Laden. Well, he didn't want to kill Bin Laden, but he was cool with killing, you know, random.
Right.
Yeah. So he's also really bad at making those calls. But yeah. So I tend to lean a little bit, maybe what would sound Alex Jonesy, but I would not at all be surprised to find that they open up a very, maybe you can call it a soft war all you want, but some kind of war on terror at home thing. I know people like you
have been
talking about it for a while, but now I'm starting to think that that it's real. It's not just like hyperbole, you know?
No, not, I mean, especially when, you know, you look at the guy's cabinet choices and who he's putting in his administration, like Chipman, I think is one of the greatest examples. I mean, you know, Biden has been very clear for quite a while that he wants to take people's guns. Now he just said that people who are spreading information that he doesn't particularly agree with are killing people, you know, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And then he puts a guy like David Chipman, who was actually on the ground in Waco, and Ruby Ridge, who's literally killed innocent men, women, and children to take their guns because the government said they couldn't have them. And then the government created this whole other narrative about how they're very dangerous terrorists. Right. Like he is not screwing around. Like, you don't put a guy like Chipman in charge if you're screwing around.
Right. Right. Well, and he's done the same thing with DOI, with Deb Haaland.
Yeah.
Gosh, what's her name? That she just wants to run the BLM. I can't remember her name right now. Tracy.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The tree spike and eco terrorist.
Yeah. Yeah. And the one who's one of her, I can't remember if it was a dissertation or what, but some paper she wrote in college about how children were, what did she call them? Basically equated them to, environmental viruses, or little pollutant monsters.
If he just wanted to put like some Greenpeace person there, or Greenpeace is even fairly radical, if he just wanted to put like some Green New Deal there, he could have hired one of like AOC's like staffers and been like, okay, see, look, we care about the environment. Nope, he's got to go and find like a literal eco-terrorist, someone who's used force to go after these policies. And then the examples just go on and on. I mean, the Health and Human Services like deputy, the transgender person, Levine, he could have picked pretty much any other transgender person, but he picked the one that's like, yeah, I think it's totally cool to give puberty blockers to kids, and then wouldn't answer the question when she was directly questioned about it. It's like, okay, like it's pretty clear the administration has no issues with lying and having people that are willing to use force that are going to be charged with going after the people that are branded as the others.
Yeah. And if there's anything about this that actually makes me feel good, is it's that I don't think that this is the first administration who's had this sort of attitude toward people like me in this country, but this is the first administration that's been brazen enough to just put it all out there. So now people are able to see it, you know? So, you know, at least maybe people are being woken up, and if not, the history books will be a lot easier to write in the end, because it'll be like the most obvious rise of like just low grade crap, Stalinistic, tyrannical, you know, but without the testosterone or the intellect is kind of the, yeah, man. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And it actually does give me a little bit of relief and gives me some optimism. It's just so blatant right now that you don't sound like a conspiracy theorist, or you don't have to really explain extremely complicated concepts to people. I mean, anyone who's remotely paying attention to the news right now, it's hard to deny a lot of this stuff, because I just think that the Biden administration, they just don't care, you know. And then all their running dogs, their lackeys, they're like, we have control of all three branches of government right now. We have the media. Let's move as fast as we possibly can. And I frankly think, and this is why I'm optimistic, that they've overplayed their hand. And there's going to be a great awakening in the country. I think, you know, whatever, back in January and February, when a lot of us were saying like, hey, this last election wasn't right, and we can prove it, people were like, you guys are crazy. But the more time that goes on, it's like, oh, wow, actually, it's looking like these guys got way too confident. And they did stick their finger on the scale in a very big way. And then same thing with January 6th. It seemed like everything from the worst insurrection in the world to like, okay, well, maybe there was just some screw up in the planning, is to like, oh, wait a sec. They completely lied about the way Sicknick was killed. And now they won't disclose how many undercover agents were part of the planning process, and they haven't charged anybody that was part of the planning process. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's all kind of getting laid out there. And I'm a little optimistic because I just think there's enough people right now in the country that are seeing it. And I think folks like us, are the majority of the country. I don't think it's all, you know, shrieking blue checks on Twitter. Thank God.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank God, because that it's hard enough just to navigate that, you know, an hour a day or whatever spread out in 15 minute intervals. I can't imagine that being my entire life. Sometimes, in fact, I get on there and I think, is this what it feels like to live in a city? It's like, just like reading people. I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. I think if you're in a lot of major American cities, it probably would seem like, you know, you just live in Twitter universe, but that's part of their scam though, isn't it? I mean, with the mainstream media and the tech oligarchs, they want to make it seem like we're just us weirdos in the hills are having these conversations and we're not the majority of the country. But it's like, no, I think most suburban rural places, which is the vast majority of America, we do feel this way, you know, and we probably even have more support in the cities. Those people just are shamed into the closet.
Yeah. And you know what, this is something that they would argue with, but I actually think is, I think they're wrong. People that live like this, that are more suburban or rural, are in actually less of a bubble than people that are in a city, because we're totally subjected to city person culture everywhere we turn and everywhere we look, and they get none of our stuff. So we have our little lives and, you know, sort of look through the window at them all the time. So, yeah, I also think that we're in some ways more culturally informed and well, within the, you know, Americana, if you will, you know, we're more broadly cultured and understand the country at large better than they do. And some of that is showing up, which, you know, this some similar stuff happened in the Obama administration. You pick too many people that are, you know, kind of leftist academic city folks, and they start to make some, they just, it shows, is what I guess what I'm trying to say. And that's happening here too. You know, you said earlier that they got the media, which is true. I mean, that's just totally undeniable. But I think was it Biden himself or maybe Psaki came out and said that something like 60% of the quote unquote COVID misinformation is coming from 11 people.
Right. Well, yeah.
So they've got a list, which, and you know,
they have a list.
Yep. Bernstein, Satchel, like I can just think of some of the people that are on there already, you know?
Yeah.
But it does show you that they are going, probably Glenn Greenwald, maybe just because they'll throw him in there somehow. But it does seem like that to me, that tips their hand in that they're realizing that they're losing control over the so-called fourth estate, you know?
Yeah.
And so they've got to ditch some of these dudes, because Bernstein, you don't have to agree with whatever he's put out, but he's been thorough on COVID this whole time. Yeah. So.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, some of it too could be they want to see like, hey, we're not coming for all you guys. It's just 11, you know, it's sort of like, it's just a mask. It's just a vaccine. It's just, you know, just get the vaccine. It's not that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of that too might be some conditioning, you know, but I do think you're right that the alternative media platforms and the fact that, you know, they can deplatform people here and there, but there are a lot of alternative sources now. It's not just, they don't just need to buy off CNN and MSNBC and Twitter. Like there's, you know, there's platforms like you're on right now where people can still share information and have their voice heard.
Yeah. And you were on Tim Pool. That's a guy who's coming up and doing some pretty cool stuff. And
Yeah.
And the alternative media space is one of the most interesting things. I don't know personally, I know you're not, but I'm kind of pro Balkanization. So I think, like, let's balkanize our media first. Let's just start decentralizing stuff and see what happens, you know, like, let's just sort of go for it.
It seems like that's definitely happening de facto. You know, I try to watch, at least listen to a little bit of left-wing stuff every now and again, but it's usually just so kind of cringe. It's hard to. It's easier when you know what the person's bias is, then you can make your own informed decision. It's the folks that are just trying to play it down the middle that usually end up having the most egregious agenda.
Yeah. And you know, I was actually talking to a mutual friend of ours the other day about this, but one of the reasons that I think that 2020 and all of this is everything that has emerged from 2020 in the alternative media space, it looks so defragmented because I think people are starting to realize that left and right are one a reason that they're so hard for people to define is that they think of them in terms of Democrat and Republican, which is the wrong way to think of left and right. And then if they don't go that way, then they use just basically economics. And they're like, well, if you're, you know, a tax and spend, then you're just on the left somewhere. And if, you know, if you're more fiscally conservative, then apparently you're on the right. But I mean, that's not been historically true, at least not broadly. It's been true in America kind of, but it hasn't been true broadly. And so it's almost like you're seeing a new, well, like what Michael Malice called a new right coalition forming. And economics are not all that important to these people because they feel like they're so imposed upon culturally and honestly, even just in their homes with their family that they're not so worried about taxes right now.
No. Yeah. And that's just been that's all that the GOP has to offer for so long. They just talk about tax cuts. They kind of throw out some libertarian talking points, but then like when they're in power, they don't even do the hard things that would actually make these tax cuts like sustainable. And it just ends up being kind of boilerplate nonsense. But then on the key cultural issues, they're the first ones to say, hey, guys, we just have to compromise on this. You know, and it's like, well, what are you, you know, that quintessential question that I think becomes more relevant every day. Well, then what are you trying to conserve? Like you're a conservative, but like on every cultural issue, we cede ground and it kind of all ends up back with this whole platform of like, well, but we don't want to pay a lot of taxes. And you're like, okay, well, who's the we? Because I see like billionaires getting tax breaks, but I see all of our taxes either staying the same or rising every now and again. There's some relief there when a Republican first comes into office, but you know, even the economic issues don't make any much sense. And again, how much are you, I mean, everyone's always worried about the economy, but when, you know, there's drag queen story hour showing up at your kid's school, you know, or you get all these bureaucrats, even in the private school, who are just like, well, you know, I guess you guys should probably just get your kids vaccinated. It's like, wait a sec. I don't even want to hear about your tax cut right now.
No. Like,
and how are you guys not fighting for this? You know, that's the question that I have for the GOP on so many different levels.
Well, look at that term that I had never heard before, mature minor. And maybe that's a legal term or something, but you know,
they made it up.
Okay. So that's an Inslee leftist term thing.
Yeah. To get control of your kids. Yeah. It's part of their agenda.
Well, there you go. Exactly. If I was living in Washington and this whole mature minor thing was happening, the last thing I would be worried about is my property taxes. I would be like, why the hell are you guys not dealing with, you know, these crazy rainbow monkey transgender story hours? Like, let's handle this stuff. And when you talk about taxes, when you're not pushing crazy crap into my children's soft brains, you know, I have a 13-year-old daughter. There is nothing mature about a 13-year-old girl. So
no, man. Yeah. And when I was a 13-year-old boy, I was freaking train wreck. Like, come on. All 13-year-olds are train wrecks. Like, come on.
Yeah. They don't understand. They barely. Yeah. Yeah. They cannot make this. Well, we have consent laws, sexual consent laws for a reason, right? Or sex consent laws for a reason. So if you can't, you know, anyway. If you can't do that, then you shouldn't be, you know, getting medical procedures performed. That's just
right.
batshit crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean, they'll cave on those major issues. And then when they talk taxes and they even want to talk economy, it's like, so I'd say low information and so transactional that it's transparent, because when it comes time to like do an actual economic heavy lift, like, hey, how about we bring back manufacturing? You get half the GOP, if not more, especially their upper echelons of their donor base that are just like, whoa, we can't do that because the upper 1% elites get this really great deal out of it because it doesn't affect us whatsoever. It doesn't affect our working class jobs. You know, it's actually good. It's actually a good thing for the elite. So they don't want to fight for that, you know, and then you get the massive bailouts in 08 after they, you know, treated Wall Street like it was a casino. And then now you have companies like, you know, BlackRock buying up subdivision after subdivision. And it's like, well, sorry, conservatives, like, continue to vote for us because we'll give you a break on your income taxes. Too bad you'll never be able to afford a house. We're right. Not going to fight that battle, you know, or your cultural battles. Every now and again, I'm going to say tax cuts and I don't know, maybe we'll build the wall. I you know, if we get to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Someone calls me a racist. I'll back off.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, we'll cut your taxes, but sorry that we shut down the business that had been in your family for 70 years and you went bankrupt on that. But hey, you know, 5% less on your income tax this year. We're doing our best, you know?
Right.
Like, yeah. I mean, because to me, the lockdowns were the most outrageous, just straight up tyrannical action I have seen in my lifetime. Yeah. I can't even believe it.
Largest transfer of wealth in our history. And I don't even think we've begun to scratch the surface of what the second order and third order effects are going to be, especially on how many small businesses were killed off.
I completely agree. Well, and think about this. They're now that they're admitting that inflation is happening, then they're going to have to raise interest rates. Well, guess who gets screwed when they hike interest rates? The middle class guy that's trying to start his business over again. Like, yep. That's not going to hurt BlackRock, you know?
Yep. And then of course, like during COVID, which companies gained, it was all the big ones. Like Walmart didn't miss a paycheck. As a matter of fact, they went up. Amazon went up because everybody was ordering things, you know, but heaven forbid the burger joint down the street did anything but take out and they couldn't sustain that. Like it's, you know, it's just absolute insanity. But again, the GOP is very happy to cater to those billionaires, because really the GOP can be bought. They just want to win the next election. They just want to get these massive, you know, campaign contributions. They don't give a crap about, you know, the working class guy whose job is getting undercut by illegal immigration, the recent college grad of student debt whose job has been taken by an Indian on an H-1B visa, or the small business owner who totally got screwed over by COVID because the government said, like, you can't, your First Amendment doesn't apply anymore.
Right. Right. And that's why it's so hard. That's partially why it's so hard not to start feeling conspiratorial when you just look at 2020, because it's just so, if you just apply logic, now we both worked for the government, so we know that's not exactly how the government works. But if you were to just apply logic to the scenario, or to the situation rather, if you have everybody locked in their homes and they've got to get out to presumably to get food and water or whatever, well, if there's a bunch of little stores open that right. gives them like options to go to, then that's spreading people out, you know, further, like decentralizing it, you would think would make it so they don't rub elbows so much and don't transmit the disease. Well, instead, our answer was, well, everything's got to be closed, but just go to Walmart because everything you need is at Walmart. So like, instead of spreading that customer base out across your city, you ended up with 20,000 people going to one Walmart. It's like, well, no wonder lockdowns seem to have perhaps spread the disease faster than not having a lockdown at all. Like, this doesn't seem hard to figure out to me, but.
Yeah. And like initially I kind of would have cut everybody a little bit of slack because it was a new thing. I mean, now we know that Fauci was being completely and totally dishonest of how much he knew, but we didn't know that then. But after, you know, come by the time this, you know, the late winter and early spring was over, I think everyone knew that we were just locking the country down for no good reason whatsoever. But that's when the financial incentive kicked in. You know, I think the government, they got more power, and government hates giving up power. And then you have all these major corporations that are just like, oh my God, this is amazing. Our business has gone up. Like Amazon's delivering like crazy. And then, you know, it, this just fits in with everything else the left's been trying to do for decades by driving people out of their small towns, locking them in cities, apartments. They're buying up all the property and all the housing. So people are going to be perpetual renters. The economy is dying minus Amazon. So you can go work in an Amazon warehouse as like your only option, you know? And again, conservatives are saying like, I don't know, maybe we'll pass the COVID spending relief bill. I guess maybe we'll get to it. And we'll send you guys some more money. Like
it's either that or it's a private company, bro. You know, it's like, those are the answers you get out of them. I think the average conservative voter, not the politicians, because the politicians are just, in my opinion, the worst people in the country right now. But I think the average conservative voter doesn't quite understand that the left just wants things centralized. They don't really care where it's centralized. So like if retail is all aggregated under Amazon and Walmart, well, sure, those are private companies, but the left doesn't care, because once it's centralized into a place, well, then it's very easy for the government to exert power over two companies. It's much harder to exert power over a decentralized market that can adjust to your laws or whatever. So they just, or what your whatever you legislate, you know, your rules. Well, same thing in the ag industry. They want Monsanto, Simplots, you know, Big Ag, Ag Inc. They want that because it's very easy to control Ag Inc., you know? And so, yeah, like this whole, it's a private company stuff. You've got to start not you, but I mean, like some of these people out there listening, you got to stop thinking in terms of public and private relationships when you're talking about these gigantic multinational corporations, because they are not and probably have never been fully private. Like, they got that big for a reason, you know what I mean?
Yeah, Amazon got its start. I mean, it's like one of the biggest and most successful companies in the world right now, but the government did give it a good deal of startup money, you know, back in the day. So they are not a private company in the way that most people think they are. I just think in general, man, like conservatives and even libertarians, to me, the question that I ask these people, because when I talk about some of my more populist nationalist policies, I get a lot of folks in the libertarians that are like, no, you can't have government involvement in the economy. And I'm like, hey, man, do we have a sovereign nation that cares deeply about its people, or do we just have an economy? Yeah. You know, that's, to me, that's the question. Like, would a nation that deeply cares about its people let all of our manufacturing jobs be shipped overseas? Now that we know, maybe at the time it seemed like a good idea, but now that we know what impact that's had on like two generations of Americans and all these small towns, would a nation that cares deeply about its people do that? Would a nation that cares deeply about its people let BlackRock go and buy up subdivision after subdivision, forcing people to be perpetual renters? Like, I don't think so. I don't care what your economic theory is. If you care deeply about your people and you're an actual sovereign nation, it's not what you do.
You're totally right. And that I would have never accepted a label or anything, but I was definitely libertarian-ish for quite some time. And I still think that in a snow globe universe, Austrian economics are probably the right way to go. But unfortunately, I think that, like, a way that I've described this before, and I want to hear what you think about it, but if you think of our sort of fiscal economic situation as if you're playing a game of Monopoly, you know how like the last 10 minutes of the game of Monopoly is a complete formality because everybody already know who won the game, like it's over, and you just keep rolling the dice because, I don't know, you just feel like you're supposed to. That's kind of where we're at right now. So if you just at least, you know, please correct me, whoever, but it seems to me that if you just implemented what these sort of Austrian economics for, or Chicago School, or any one of these more very conservative economic plans, that all that would happen is Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos would own the Rocky Mountains, and, you know, the rest of us would be. Yeah, I mean, it would just be over. It would be completely over. You think you have an oligarchy now. You would have like little tiny, basically Amazon-sponsored nations throughout this country. It would be technocratic communism but it, well, it'd be some version of technocratic communism. It'd be some very weird fascist mess. You know, it'd be something you'd probably have to name. You'd have to come up with your own name, but it would be some totally tyrannical, technocratic, oligarchic system that you would probably never be able to break, you know?
I don't see how we're continuing to justify it other than we're running on, I think the GOP is counting on people not paying attention, and then left is counting on people being so blinded with their hatred for the other side that they're just letting this slide. And the left has done a really good job of stamping out most of their populist ideas and replacing it with this woke culture. You know, because Tim Pool talks about it all the time, but there was a time when like the Occupy movement, and even before that, the anti-World Trade Organization guys were talking about the same populist economic issues mm-hmm. in the late 90s and the mid 2000s. But then the woke ideology got pumped in into the left, and that became the centering principle on the left wing, as opposed to populist economic ideas. And we had a chance with Trump, as imperfect as an instrument as he is, when he broke through the wall and said like, hey, we can actually turn this around. We can bring back manufacturing jobs. We can do the right thing by our people. You can critique Trump all day long for the way that the execution took place, but he broke through that ideology on the right, you know, in many ways. But I think it's really hard to justify right now what is going on. So that's another reason why I am optimistic, because I think there's a lot of people who would have had major ideological objections, you know, 5, 6, 10 years ago for us saying some of the things that we're saying, you know, right now. I think people are hopefully going to be woken up to it.
I think you're totally right. I'm probably an example of this, because 5 or 6 years ago, the idea of being even tangentially connected to Republicans, I would have been like, get out of here, man. No way. You know, I just couldn't stand those people. And now I'm totally like, I'm looking for allies wherever I can find them right now. And I think there are other people, you know, just to deal with the problems that we're having immediately. And we can talk about the nuances later on, but like, let's solve this. Exactly. Like, we've got some pretty big issues that we should be able to at least come together on. Like, let's not let weirdos twerk in front of our kids, or you know, like, let's stop having CNN supporting, you know, this child stripping and stuff. Like, come on, man, this is fucking insane. Like,
it's insane, man. Hey, are you able to pause this real quick? I gotta go grab my kid, he's screaming. I'll be right back.
No problem, bro. Can push this. Okay, I didn't know what it would do actually right there. I kind of forgot we had a family emergency to take care of there, which I get, man. If my kids were home, I'd be like, I had to do one of these one time when my wife was gone, and I can't actually remember who I was doing it with, but I could hear my kids pounding on something on the wall upstairs. So I've been there. I know what you're going through, man. But
yeah,
anyway, I don't want to waste too much of your time today, but we were talking about allies and that kind of stuff. And I've got kind of a little bit of a weird audience, and I'm hoping that maybe we can get some people in that area that are more maybe libertarian type, or even to the right of libertarian type people, to understand how important this race is, at least to me. So when I look at your campaign, well, obviously I think a lot of you as a man, so that's part of it, but you're a big family guy, which is huge to me. And after that, probably the number two thing is you want to get out of all these stupid wars that we've been fighting for 20 years, and like, just stop wasting blood and treasure. So
amen.
I think for like the libertarian types, that's a big selling point. It has been, like, I think I've told you this before, you and Ron Paul are the only two politicians I've ever donated to. And
well, thanks, man.
And that's, you know, honestly, a huge part of it is the warfare state. And so, you know, if we can get more guys like you that are in a position to speak from authority on this. Like, no one can try to pull your card and be like,
that sounds like, right,
like some kind of wuss or something. It's like, well, I'll tell you. I'm sure
David French will come try and punk me out, I'm sure.
Isn't he a jag?
He was a jag. At least he went. I mean, unlike Bill Kristol and all those other knucklehead neocons, you know, like,
yeah. Yeah, David French. Holy crap. But yeah, so that's a big deal. That's a really big deal to people right now. And of course, we're doing this Afghanistan withdrawal, which is great. I mean, I'm definitely one of those people that I don't actually even care who gets them out of there at this point. Like, let's just get out of there.
Nope. Me either, man. I mean, I say Biden should have done it when he was vice president, like you said, but hey, I'll give him all the credit right now. Like, as long as he gets them out, I don't care. I mean, the obvious question is, like, why do they fight Trump so hard when he was trying to do this exact same thing? And then they just sort of, you know, glossed over the whole fact that they lied about the Russian bounties. And suddenly, like, that's not a big deal that they lied about the Russian bounties to keep our troops in harm's way for another year. But hey, whatever. I don't care. Just pull them out now.
Yeah. And yeah. You know what's so, and this is, I know that you understand this, but just for anyone listening, when they do something like that, every single person who was wounded or killed after that is a life that is, in my opinion, that blood is on their hands. I mean, they don't see it this way, but I sure do, you know?
Yeah. It's all a game to them. Yeah. But absolutely. No, I totally see it that way. And there's just been so many different chapters in both the Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria. There was these inflection points where we could have gotten people out, but we just chose not to. So like you said, I don't care who gets them. I'm just glad that they, you know, people were freaking out like, oh my God, we just left Kandahar in the middle of the night. And I was like, well, thank God.
Right.
Good. Yeah. Good. Yeah. You're not going to catch me saying good to the Biden administration very often, but good on them.
Like, yeah. Right. I feel exactly.
Next to Iraq. That was a good battle drill. Do it out of Iraq now.
Yeah. No kidding. And yeah. And one of the, yeah. And Syria too. Like, let's get out of there. A fear that I have with this, though, is the sort of neoliberal coalition has always been war hawkish. I don't know where we got this idea that they weren't, but they have always been war hawkish. They opposed the Vietnam War. Well, it's a good, so a bunch of communists didn't want Americans killing communists in another country. Like, okay. If that's your, you know, if that's your definition of, you know, anti-war, then whatever. But
and Biden's got a very pro-war crew in there right now. So, I mean, the question is going to be what's next. I mean, I think some of it is going to be the internal war on domestic extremists or whatever they're calling it, the war on the deplorables. That's definitely a part of it. But yeah, I mean, whatever we can do to get folks out. And then also just to, I think, again, Trump being the imperfect blunt object that he was and he is, the way that he busted through the national security establishment, especially of right-wing thinking, even people that don't truly believe that we need to get out of the wars, they kind of have to say we do now because Trump shamed so many of them into it. And so did the base that, you know, I think that's been overall a good thing. I don't know what the breakthrough is going to be on the left. They seem like the left gets in lockstep much better. So like what they did to, you know, Tulsi Gabbard, for example, is just shows how much of an uphill battle that's going to be.
Oh, you're spot on. And I worry, I'm sure other people are saying the same thing. I don't think it's like some kind of profound observation, but I really do worry that they're going to try to spin up a Cold War type thing with China because it makes a lot of sense. Now you can say, you know what, as part of our infrastructure package, we need to get our steel mills up and operating back in Pennsylvania again, you know, because what if we do end up in a hot war? We need steel produced. And, you know, they can start pulling strings like this in these sort of purple states and try to ensure, you know, another election victory as well. And then China makes a lot of sense because they really are probably the closest thing we have to a near peer on the planet. Mm-hmm. And they have been aggressive and they've got nukes and all of that, but they also probably don't really want to go to war with us right now outside of a Cold War, you know?
No, so, I mean, they don't need to because of what they're doing with the economy. I mean, like all of our production lines are over there. We rely on China to buy off our debt bonds. I mean, that's why I do think that we need to get on a wartime footing to get manufactured back in the country just for national security reasons alone, but then also, you know, moral reasons as well. We need to give people the opportunity to graduate high school and be able to go into a job that can help they that can help them raise a family on, you know?
Sure. I agree with you. I agree with that for sure. I don't know how you go about that, but I agree with that 100%. And, you know, throughout all of this, we're still China's customer, you know, like our largest, you know, importer, right? We import more from them than anyone. So kind of stayed on their tee, but, and then, you know, you have these neoliberals in there who are convinced that what brought us out of the Great Depression was World War II. You know, it just seems like they're all of the, I don't want to say incentives, but, you know, everything sort of aligns in such a way that it would make sense for them to start getting very loud about China. And I mean, we'll see. And maybe I'm not even saying we need to pay attention to China. I'm not saying we don't need to pay attention to China. It just seems like I worry about where they go with that, you know.
Pretty obsessed with Russia. That's the concern. I think the Biden administration has so many deep economic ties to China. They want to keep the status quo of us being deeply indebted to them, but they use Russia kind of as a straw man. I don't think Russia's anywhere near the boogeyman they think it is. Yeah, I get it. Putin's a bad guy. I mean, but if you really care about Putin, then you, you produce your own oil and you punish the Europeans for buying his oil, because Russia is just a, you know, gas station of nukes essentially. But they love making up all these, they're not making it up, but they love making a big deal about like, oh my God, what about Russia? Well, Russia, I think Texas's economy is like twice the size of Russia's, you know, like they're not the threat. But then you start looking at the head-to-head economic comparison that we have with China. And then you're like, okay, actually these guys are definitely major players, you know?
Sure. Yeah. None of us really, I don't want to sit here and pretend to be an expert, but I listened to a couple of podcasts about stuff in the Pacific Theater, one of the Hoover Institution ones I try to keep up on because I just didn't really know a lot about China. And it does sound like experts are kind of all over the place on China, whether their economy is real or whether it's not real, like what actually happens in business in China. I've heard widely disparate stories about. So it sounds like maybe we don't actually fully understand the way, or what we don't fully understand what position China's economy is actually in. So there's that too, or at least it seems like that to me from the outside, which would make I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just don't think we've dedicated the resources to it. And a lot of that's just like, you know, there's only so many hours in the day, and the intelligence community and the DOD has just been focused on building democracies out of Pashtun tribes and Arab militias for the last two decades. You know, this is a pretty huge gap. Like, how come we have the vast majority of our military and intelligence community that can tell you about the tribal dynamics of, you know, Peshawar and Anbar province, Iraq? Meanwhile, China's like gobbling up strategic ports throughout the world. And you're like, oh shit, man, actually, we probably should have been paying attention to that. But I do feel like if we put our mind to it, we could bring back our manufacturing in this country and our energy independence in this country in a way that no country, no nation in the world could screw with us, because this nation is truly blessed by divine providence. I mean, the resources we have in this country alone, we could provide for our people and not really have to worry about as many foreign adventures.
Yeah, I mean, we have lithium too. I don't know exactly how we're fixed for cobalt, but we have got lithium. And so, yeah, we're sort of set up to move into the future that way. And I agree with that. It'd be great to, I mean, I like the idea of becoming as, this is where libertarians get a little bit weird to me. And it's mostly because I probably don't have as deep of an understanding as I need to have, but they want free and fair trade, which is great, fine. But they have this major focus on personal financial freedom, you know, like sovereignty within your own home. And sure, trade, go ahead and trade with people, but make sure that you've taken care of yourself first. But somehow they don't scale that to, you know, the nation or their community. And that part I don't get, because I'm like, yeah, let's trade with whoever we can. But let's also like make sure we're solvent here in America.
Exactly. You know?
Like, that would be nice.
Right. So,
yeah. But all right, man, I've had you for an hour here and I don't want to drag you out any longer. But so tell us how we can, like, what would be the best way to help you? Because I know in a primary, money matters a lot, but also people on, like, support on the ground, I would think would be a big deal in a primary.
Definitely is, man. So our volunteer base is going really well. We're around 255 volunteers. Like I told you before, we're texting back and forth. You actually got some fans in a couple of our rural counties. I've had people that come up and like, hey man, I heard you on Braxton's show for the first time. So that's that definitely helps, man. So yeah, if you're out in the third district and you want to volunteer, come on out, joekentforcongress.com. There's a volunteer link on there, or just send us an email and we'll get you set up. Or just come out and see us at one of the events. The donations help. 5, 10, 15 bucks goes a long way. And we're running solely off of donations. So I beat all my other competitors too, including the incumbent on individual donations. The only reason the incumbent beat me on overall numbers is because of PAC money. And she's getting PAC money from all the usual bad actors. But I want to really draw people's attention to the fact that Kevin McCarthy, the leader of the GOP, is supporting one of the impeachment voters, and not just the one of the impeachment voters, the one that volunteered to be like the Democrat star witness in the impeachment trial, and the one that's really been a zealot about the January 6th narrative that's being weaponized against all of us. So this is a classic example of like the GOP just thinks we're not paying attention. They think they can go on Fox News and say like, boy, aren't the libs crazy? Socialism sucks. Send me money. Meanwhile, they fund the very people that are smacking the Trump base in the face. So yep. Don't give your money to the GOP. Give your money to a candidate, an America First candidate that actually, you know, reflects your ideas. So the donations really help too.
Awesome. And for God's sake, vote in the primary. I know a lot of people don't vote in primaries.
I know. But... seriously. Yep.
All right, brother. Thank you.
Thanks, man.
We'll just keep pushing you every time someone invites me on their stuff too.
Oh, please do, man. Yeah. And I'll come back anytime. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, brother. Thank you. I want to say thanks again to Joe Kent for coming on. Please, if you're in Washington, volunteer to support that guy. He is the best candidate in this race. He's anti-war, and he's got the creds to be so. Follow him on Twitter. All you guys probably already do follow him on Twitter. He's got a great Twitter game. I'm sure he's on all the... well, I know he's on Instagram. I'm sure he's on all the other, you know, like Boomer, Facebook, and this kind of stuff. But go follow him everywhere. Support the guy. Give money if you can. He's the only politician that we need to get elected in this race, and we really, really need that guy in office. I'm not a Republican, as you guys know, but I will do everything I can to help that guy get in, because we need somebody like that speaking against Bill Kristol and these other neocon warmongering. I had to edit that a little bit because I'm trying to be kinder, gentler, Braxton. I said some stuff in a space the other day that I shouldn't have said. Got a little too wound up. So I'm trying not to get myself kicked off of these socials, so I'm going to go ahead and cut out that last part that I said. Support Joe however you can. Please follow me on Twitter. Glass Factory is going to ship, or has already shipped. You're going to be getting those things soon. And thank you guys. Next week, we're going to talk to Drew Holden about a story that you guys have already forgotten about because the news cycle travels, you know, moves so quickly. But we're going to talk about Fauci's emails and remind you guys what was in that email dump. Drop, whatever you want to call it. It was a dump. It was definitely a dumpster fire. But we're going to go through that and remind you guys what was in there. So tune in. Take care.